I steal your bicycle, you have to take the bus. But if I just copy it, there's one for each of us.
And with shoe polish, I wrote antiwar.com and anti-war patriot.
The fact is, people, 95% of what they do, moving closer to a goal.
The future is simply digital fabrication.
Yeah, we're free in a sense that we don't live in the barn. We live in forests.
You can adjust your politics to this reality. You will not ask me to adjust mine.
Pogo and a Nazi, spit upon a Jew. Vicious violence, violence, got offers, nothing new. Left-wing violence, right-wing violence, all seem like the same. Bully boys out fighting, it's just the same old game. Boring fact in politics, still get us all shot. Left-wing, right-wing, you can stuff the lot. Keep your petty prejudice, I don't see the point. Anarchy and freedom is what I want.
Welcome to Anarchist Garage.
I guess the idea here, G-Man, you and I have been going back and forth on Twitter a little bit about this whole corona thing. And not so much the virus piece of it, because like Carr and I have been going back and forth about how bad the math is, and it's like you can't know anything right now because all the data sets are screwed.
Yes, I agree.
So you can't, you have, there's no concept of how bad it is, could be, was, might be. And the craziest part about the whole thing is like we might not ever know.
Yes.
In fact, I think we might not ever actually know for sure how any of this was.
I absolutely agree with that. I think that the fog of war is going to persist for years, and then only in retrospect will we come close.
And even then, like, because you spent the first 6 months not testing, like, you can't, like, you have no idea how many people got it, got over it, never got tested, never, like, it got blamed on a particularly bad flu season. Like, you can't, because the testing wasn't there, you can't know.
Correct.
And so, yeah, you just, even in a, like, retrospective manner, the math is, and the math is so complicated in the first place because there's so many variables.
Mm-hmm.
That the fact that you have no testing to speak of for the first 4 or 5 months of this thing means any data set that you work with is flawed from the jump. And so you might get somebody who gets an estimate that's like, oh, yeah, technically that's pretty damn close, or as close as you can ever be on these things, but you can't actually know.
Right.
And that's not even factoring in the variety of people that have various motivations to misrepresent the data.
Totally. I'm trying to, like, stay away from all of that, right? All the conspiracy theory stuff, all the, like, event 201. There's plenty of good people to go look at, like, you know,
even conspiracy stuff, just pure, just, like, sheer political.
There's the sheer political stuff, but then there's also, like, Monica Perez and a couple other people have been really good about, like, hey, they've been wargaming this thing. And they had a, like, basically public event that laid all of this out, like, 6 months ago. And so, ignoring all of that, right? Ignoring and giving them the benefit of the doubt of like, hey, that's good public policy. We were practicing. This is the thing that we think is the highest level threat event for humans. So that's what we were wargaming, blah, blah, whatever. Just taking all of that at face value and taking the like, hey, we have no idea how bad this thing is and we can't know how bad it is and we might not ever know how bad it is or was. The economics piece of it, we can look at that really cleanly and go, what in the actual fuck did you guys just do?
Yeah, that is something that is much more imminently measurable is the economic impact of it, because we already have systems in place to measure economic activity. You know, like it's already laid out there. There's all kinds of numbers and charts and metrics that are previously in place just to measure economic health generally, and it's not good. It's real bad.
I've been trying really hard, right, like to stay somewhat positive. I kind of taken my cues from Carr, like Carr is Mr. like silver linings, sunshines in the rainstorm kind of thing, of like, mm-hmm. it's kind of bad, but like here's all these other opportunities that are going to come from this, and like I'm trying to like, and I just keep looking at it going, yeah, maybe eventually we'll be able to look back at it and go, oh, well, if this hadn't happened, none of these other good things happened. But man, the like, especially because of the responses to it, right? Like, hey, we're just going to make up $6 trillion out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, instead of just letting it reset and working its way through its natural order, like, they're just going to make it worse. And it's going to, dude, And it's the crazy part that I think everybody misses is like, oh yeah, we just like told non-essential businesses to go home and we shut down trade with China and Italy and parts of Africa and parts of Central America. And like, you know, I was talking to a friend today and he's like, hey, you know, I'm still considered essential and that's all good. And I got a buddy that's considered essential. He works for some company. I think they make industrial washing machines, like industrial laundry equipment. He's like, so they're considered essential for whatever reason, and they're still working where they have been, but they're going to run out of components next week. So they've already been told that they're going to shut down the factory when they run out of the essential components.
And I had the exact same thing, another exact story to that from my friend here who's essential but going to lose her job because they've just run out of stuff.
I mean, I follow an ammo manufacturer on Instagram, and he's saying, hey, I'm working as hard as I can to keep components in stock, and we're loading ammo as fast as we can load it, but we're going to run out of primers. When exactly, I don't know, but it's coming because Federal has been bought out by the feds completely. Federal and Winchester both got completely bought out by the feds, their entire production line for the rest of the year. Fiocchi, the other big manufacturer of primers, is in Italy, and they're shut down.
They're shut down
and can't export.
Yep.
So the three major manufacturers of primers in the world are shut down. Yep. Federal and Winchester have been bought out by the feds for the rest of the year, and Fiocchi can't export. So, like, hey, ammo is, like, short, and I was talking to, like, I'm a gun guy, and I've got a lot of friends that are, like, super gun guys. And so we're talking about, like, man, ammo went quick this time. Because, like, 5 years ago, ammo went, and it went fast. But it was, like, 3 or 4 months before it was all kind of cleared out. And then it took about a year and a half before everything was kind of back to normal. And I'm looking at this thing going, hey, guys, there wasn't a production. It was just a rush, right? It was just a demand rush. They thought Obama was coming for the guns or whatever. It was after not Sandy Hook. It was after the Florida, the Stoneman Douglas High School, Parkland. It was after that. Like, there was a massive rush on ammo. And what happened was basically everybody's inventory got cleared out. And it took the regular manufacturing process about a year and a half to catch back up to demand. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot longer this time.
Like, that actually is a really good example of something that I think not everyone, but a lot of people are kind of underestimating, is there's a huge demand spike for certain items, like primers is a great example, but there's also a huge supply crunch, like, for example, washing machine time. Parts. Yeah, it's at the same time.
Like, or like primers. Primers are getting hit on both ends. Massive demand spike and massive supply shortage.
Yeah, so you either have, and everything has suffered an event of some sort. It's either a demand spike or demand collapse, or a supply collapse. There's not really a supply spike, except, you know, of presumed inventory sales and growth. So, and some of them, like primers, are hit from both ends. They're getting demolished on the supply side and on the demand side. So there's a lot of moving parts to the economic outfall of this. And to circle back to what you were talking about earlier, like, I also believe that there is opportunity for the individual in this kind of event, like this market that we're finding ourselves in. The problem is, a lot of people are entirely unprepared for this and are heavily vested in the lifestyle that they were living, which is not conducive to, like, agile maneuvering in the marketplace. You know, just 9-to-5ers are getting blown out, you know.
It's 9-to-5ers who are in debt up to their eyeballs already, right? Yes. Because they got hit in 2008 and are just barely starting to, like, catch back up from 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they still haven't paid the credit cards off. They haven't paid the student debt loans off. Or it's been 10 years. They got hit in 2008. The kids graduated from high school. They put on a whole bunch of college student loan debt to pay for their kids for school, whatever, blah, blah. And so, like, if you look at the numbers from 2008, 2009, 2010, between, and then now, all of the debt load, all the household debt, all the consumer debt, all the car loans, all the everything is up, right?
Yeah.
Like, and not a little bit up, like multipliers up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
not 10%, this is a, hundreds this, of percent.
It's the timing on this, in my opinion, could not have been worse because.
Well, it was. This was always going to happen. I had this conversation with my dad a couple of days ago of like, hey, you know, this is the result of the boomers not allowing things to reset. It should reset in the 90s. It should have reset in the early 2000s. It should have reset in 2008. And they keep reinflating the bubble. And if they would just have let it reset, they would have taken a ding and we could reset all the right numbers and nobody would be having to go through this again. But because they keep reinflating the bubble, it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Yeah. And now, as the boomers are like all either dying or like they're every boom, my dad is either my mom or my dad is like the last year of the boomers, technically.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all like my dad's 62 or he'll be 62 this year. And so, like, he's 3 years away from retiring.
Mm-hmm.
So, the older end of the boomers are dying off, the youngest end of the boomers are starting to retire. And just as they're starting to retire, you're going to wipe out all of their investments, the housing and the stock market, and it's all going to get wiped out. And if they had taken the hit 15 years ago or 20 years ago when they still had working life left in them and they could have fixed it, it wouldn't have wiped them out. And so I'm looking around going, man, they've been putting this off to avoid the pain and put the pain on the next generation and the generation after that because they'll have time or whatever. I'm like, yeah, except you guys have kicked the can down so far down the road that this time, if it completely implodes, y'all are going to get the worst of it. You're going to catch the worst of it by a large margin because y'all own everything.
Yeah.
Y'all are the ones that are in the stock market. Y'all are the ones that have the big, fancy, expensive houses. Y'all are the ones that are super leveraged. You didn't stay in the same house for 40 years like your parents did and paid off the mortgage. And so you're sitting on an asset. You're still leveraged to the hilt. And so I mean, it's just like.
It's exactly as you're saying. And the other thing is like, for someone of my age, I'm in my 30s, like, it is conceivable and likely that the stock market will go up after time. It may be like a 3 to 7 year bear market, but eventually I will have, you know, investment opportunities along the way. They don't have that time. Kicking the can so long has forced their hand. And now, like you said, stocks, real estate, pension funds are getting demolished. I think one of the biggest overall indicators I've seen out of this was California's public pension fund had like a 60-some billion-dollar loss because of this. Because they were...
Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of big numbers that have come out already that people, like, they're not really paying close enough attention to because the impact of them isn't immediate. Like, everyone's
it's going to take a year. It's going to take a year for this. Like, the dominoes have all been tipped over.
Mm-hmm.
All of the little things have been triggered. Everything's going.
Mm-hmm.
But for it to work down through the system to reach the average person, it's going to take a year before everybody realizes what happened.
Yeah. The largest impacts are yet to come. I think the short-term cash flow impacts are going to be important to watch still. Like, the rental market right now is super interesting because...
I mean, we had that conversation 3 or 4 days ago when Cheesecake Factory said, hey, we're not paying rent April 1st.
Yeah.
Across all of our properties to all of our landlords. Yeah. Sorry for you. And I just went... Oh, commercial real estate is fucked.
Yeah, and they were already shaky to begin with.
Commercial real estate's always shaky.
Right.
But they've all got all this like online retail presence stuff that's kicking their ass to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And then you toss this on top of that, and it's like commercial real estate might not ever recover. It's like it probably won't look the same ever. And it's definitely not going to look the same for 20 years.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to decimate that market.
I would agree with that. Like, I mean, and, you know, I preface this by saying, like, this is not something that I'm looking forward to, or you know, I think any of this is good. It's just talking about the facts of the matter and like trying to dissect this as it's happening.
Well, like I said, this has been coming for 50 years, realistically, and 100 years, really, like from 1913 on. Like, this was the inevitable outcome of the Federal Reserve and the removal of the gold. This is inevitable, right? And in 71, they had a chance to reset, and instead they unpegged from gold.
Right.
And so, really, this has been coming for 50 years. The boomers have been pushing it and 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 going like, yeah, we're just never going to deal with this.
Yeah, and you can't avoid certain market consequences forever. Like, there comes a point where you have to pay the piper for, you know, like, you can do stuff. Like, and the thing is, like, under a less extreme event, like, they were able to kick the can, you know, through 9/11 and through 2008, like, they were able to bring it back from the brink and kick the can down the road. The problem is, there's nothing to do right now. There's no safe place. There's nothing that's investment worthy. Everything shut down, economic standstill, you know? So you can't print money out of that. Like, that's too big of a hole, you know? It's their usual tricks to continue the charade aren't going to work on this. Like, it's too much of a real event to just ignore or cover over it with a patch.
Yeah, I think, I'm just looking at it going like, hard assets are your, like, and not, I'm not talking like rental real estate. I'm talking food, like being able to grow food, like land.
Beans, bullets, bandages.
Yeah. And then there's certain companies, right, that produce certain things that are critically essential items, right, that you could theoretically run to that are going to survive this, right? You can look for companies that have managed their debt load appropriately and make things that everybody needs, their, you know, consumer goods. But, man, even those companies are going to take a hit because if nobody has money, right? Here's the math that my mother-in-law is a school teacher, and they shut all the schools down in Texas for the rest of the year, and they did it like 3 weeks ago. And I was just doing the math. It's like, okay, so let's say they shut all the schools down nationwide for the rest of the year, right, for a quarter, for 3 months. About 60% of the workforce has kids, and almost everybody's a two adult working households. So say half of that 60% has to stay home. So 30% of the population has to find some way to stay home and stay with their kids. And most of those people are going to be the lower income earning person in the relationship, right? So you're looking at like a 15% decline in household revenue across the U.S. for quarter one, or I guess Q2 at this point.
Right.
That's just the effect of closing the schools.
Yeah.
Don't look at anything else. What is a 15% decline in household revenue do to your annual budget and your subjective spending, right? Like, hey, we were going to go to Disneyland this year. No, the fuck we're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were going to buy a new car this year. No, the fuck you're not.
Yeah.
Right? So think about all the downstream spending that isn't going to happen. And the downstream effects of all that 15% of Q2 lost revenue does in Q4 lost revenue because that money wasn't spent in Q2.
Yeah, it's a complete
exponential
cascade. Yeah.
It's a cascading exponential, and it just grows.
What do you guys think of the unemployment numbers, the estimate that came out from the St. Louis Fed?
Insane.
Yeah.
That was what was the estimate? Like 50 million unemployed?
The last number I saw was 32 million, which would be 25%. it's depression. It's depression level. Like,
do you think they're on target with that though, or do you think that's just like a wild, complete, off the wall guess?
I think they're low. I think they're way low.
I think that they're low. I mean, they aimed real low on the initial jobless claims. Like, I think they were guessing like 1.6 mil, and it was like 3.3 mil.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I mean, that's one of those numbers where it's so big that it is hard to track, and like it doesn't take into account. I'm guessing I haven't looked at the formula.
It but only
I'm
counts it people who apply for unemployment benefits.
Right.
That's all that number is. That number is new unemployment claims.
So if you're self-employed, or if you're a gig worker, or you know you just
decided, hey, I'm getting 2 weeks or 3 weeks of unpaid time off, but my job is still sitting there. Right. Mm-hmm. They didn't lay me off, so I can't go file for unemployment because I didn't actually get fired. I'm furloughed. Yeah. I'm getting partial payment or no payment, but my job's still there, so I can't claim on it. Doesn't count any of that.
Yeah.
It just counts unemployment claims.
Yep.
3.3 million in under a week. It's madness.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those situations where, like, I've been looking at the numbers for a while, and, like, I've been paying fairly close attention to it, but I don't often, like, sit down and think about it all in context, mostly because it's just so extreme, you know? Like, the gravity of it becomes a lot more clear when you do sit down and think about all of these factors at once. And then you go and you look, and the Dow closed up like what, 800 points today? You know,
I didn't even bother. That number doesn't mean anything.
No, it's completely fake. Like that's, and I mean even
by the way, the Fed has admitted that they are open to the concept of buying stock directly.
Oh yeah. I mean that's gonna happen.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average doesn't mean shit.
No, it's literally
a damn thing. That number is completely artificial at this point.
Yeah, that's one of the things that actually, perversely enough, is probably going to help in the short term and hurt significantly in the long term.
Yep.
Because there are going to be people, and they're like, "Well, the stock market hasn't crashed. How bad could it be?" And then there's no food, there's no gasoline, you know, whatever consequences manifest for their local area, but they're going to have that false sense of security because, well, Big Line went up today, so it must be all right, you know?
Yep.
They don't understand what it means for the Federal Reserve to just buy stocks like that. Yeah.
I think the vast majority of people have like no idea how bad it is or what's coming.
No, they really don't.
I mean, G-Man, you and I were talking the other day about like, it's so like even in our circles of people who kind of sort of have a half decent grasp of this stuff don't get it.
No. And I mean, in fairness, I do get it. Why? Because it's hard. Like it's difficult to sit down and look at it and be like, actually confront the realities of it and recognize the danger of the situation going forward. And I don't really blame anyone if they don't want to confront that. I kind of get mad when I see people like actively downplaying it as though it's nothing, because I'm like, in my mind that could be harmful. Like if someone sees that and like doesn't change their behavior.
Yeah. I mean, Scott Horton had David Stockman on last week.
Mm-hmm.
And I generally like Stockman. I think he's really good at analyzing the data and like crunching hard numbers, and he's got a historical perspective. But I posted on Twitter later after listening to that episode of like, man, the naivete of boomer economists, even free marketeers, would be adorable if it wasn't so dangerous. Because he's like, hey, as soon as we can get back to work, as soon as capitalism goes back to work, we'll just pop right back out of this thing. I'm like, you're out of your goddamn mind.
Yeah.
You have no clue the train that is about to just smash this economy.
Like just the income disruption alone is absolutely staggering.
And you could maybe paper over that, right? Mortgage and rent forgiveness or moratoriums, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, hey, nobody pays rent, but nobody pays mortgages, and it's a wash, right? Everybody just ignore March and April, just pretend like it didn't exist, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. You could maybe paper over the income loss if that was the only problem.
Right.
But that's the smallest problem. Mm-hmm. Like, y'all just shut down trade with China for six yep. weeks. No ships coming, no stuff coming, no essential components. So even mm-hmm. if you shut this stuff on, it's going to take a month or more just to get the stuff across the ocean and back into the factories to get stuff put back together.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's like, that's something
it hasn't even started yet.
That part has been obvious to me for a long time, just from the China side of it, because they shut their factories down, and my first thought was, oh shit, that's the beginning of the supply chain for every item in the whole world. Like,
almost
down just about everything. Like, yep. enough so that it doesn't make much of a difference. But, like, even
toilet
like
paper. Toilet paper is not on the list. Toilet paper is made 100% in the USA.
Yep. That is a domestic industry. God bless them. But, like, even like the machines, you know, those have to have,
oh, yeah.
like, transistors and diodes and resistors. Oh,
yeah. And eventually, like, if that supply chain doesn't get picked up and the manufacturing doesn't come back to the U.S., and nobody's making parts, eventually even the toilet paper guys are going to have machinery down and right. not be able to produce. Yep.
Yeah.
Totally.
And that's something that I'd mentioned in one of my threads talking about this, is you might have situations where the price of something is down, but the supply of it is also restricted, because you get the demand yep. side crunch because no one's buying it. And then you get the supply side crunch because they can't get parts.
Yep.
So they're getting hit from both sides, like two cars crushing a dude, you know?
Yeah. It's so I've been having this conversation with my family pretty actively, because none of us are actually sitting on cash right now, but we've all got a bunch of cash coming. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, all right, everybody just keep your powder dry.
Yep.
Hold on, because everything's about to go on sale.
Yep.
So if you have cash, if you're sitting on a pile of cash, or less good scenario, but still a good scenario, your credit lines are empty and you can just rack it up, everything's about to go on sale.
Yeah.
Land, have you seen equipment, housing, all of it?
Have you seen how bad the new car market is so far?
Did you see my thread about the Jeep financing?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep.
Holy
84
fuck.
Months, zero interest.
0%, 84 months, and no payments for the first 90 days with approved credit. And I was like, yeah. oh, my God. They know. Like,
yeah.
the Chrysler Automotive obviously knows that yeah. they are super screwed. They're like, we're going to be sitting with cars that are dry rotting on the lots. Mm-hmm. Because we're not going to be able to sell cars.
And that's another market that was already really soft. Like, new cars.
Yeah, because we're at capacity. Everybody's got a car. Most people have two. Like, mm-hmm. most families have two cars. Like, everybody who wants a car has a car.
Yep.
And so your only market is building cars for people as their cars die.
Yep.
And so you look at that and you go, yeah, but they're building cars like it's 1990. Mm-hmm. And most families only have one car, and we're trying to get to two cars, except yep. that we've been at car saturation for like 10 years.
Yep.
And they didn't slow down production. They just kept ramping it up. They got cars for clunkers to get rid of the used car market as much as they could and jack the prices of cars up, because cars have gotten stupid expensive. Like, a brand new Ford F-250, like, maxed out is $115,000. It's madness. Madness. And people are taking out 96-month loans on that.
Yeah.
It's a house, you dumb motherfuckers. Like, what yeah. are you doing?
And imagine that guy, his payment, it's probably like $700 or $800
oh, no.
a month.
$1,200 a month. I've looked.
$1,200, my God. And he's defaulting.
$1,200 a month. You yeah. know how cheap 2018 and 2019 F-250s are going to be in a year?
Oh my God. It, yeah. Like, I can't wait to go on the Craigslist.
Look, I'm not a particularly sympathetic person unless I know you and we're friends, and then I can be very sympathetic. Mm-hmm. But on the like grand scale, you know, it's the Stalin quote, like a person is a tragedy, a million people's a statistic. I fall into that trap a lot, but I'm very empathetic. So I understand very clearly how painful this is going to be for a lot of people.
Right.
But I know for a fact I'm coming out the other end of this thing, like way on top.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking at it going, man, vehicles are about to get ridiculously cheap. Mm-hmm. And, you know, cash hasn't been king at the car dealership for like 15 years because the way their incentives are structured, they don't make money selling the car. They make money on finance and on parts and service and on maintenance. They don't make any money selling the car, getting it off the lot. And so if you go in there cash, they're going, well, we're not making any money. And they don't want to talk to you, right?
Yep.
That thing's about to get flipped on its head. They're not going to be able to finance anything.
And right now,
they're not
going
to be able to sell anything. And they've got debt payments.
It's not even a matter of making money off of you. It's a matter of getting those assets.
It's just revenue generation and getting liabilities off the books.
Yeah, because to get the assets off the books.
It's not assets. It's liabilities.
Well,
they've got a loan. They've got a floor loan on those cars from the manufacturer. So the dealer owes the manufacturer money every month that car sits there.
Yeah.
In 90 days, 120 days, they're going to be desperate for selling cars. I mean, I'm going to have cash because I've got a lawsuit settlement coming. I already know how much I'm getting. It's just a matter of when it shows up. And we were already in the market for a new car, and we're looking and this and that and the other thing. And I know the car we're looking at is a Honda Odyssey. But we were looking at 2019s because they still have 2019s on the lot. Like a bunch of them, especially in Dallas and Houston, if I'm willing to drive a little bit and go get them. They've got 2019s sitting on the lot. I'm going, cool, I'm going to get a like maxed out 2019 Honda Odyssey for nothing. And now I'm looking at it going, oh, no. I'm getting a 2020 Honda Odyssey loaded for a song.
Yeah. And this is another one of those situations like where Jeep, they're going first. They're going to be first.
They're a luxury vehicle.
Yeah.
They're not a high-end luxury vehicle. They're a fun to have mid-class car. Mm-hmm. Nobody buys a Jeep as a practical vehicle. Mm-hmm. They're super impractical.
So what they're trying to do is they're trying to be the first ones. Yeah, they're trying to absorb all of these people that are trying to get the deal, and the people are running to get the deal, not knowing the deals have just started. Like
if you will just pump the brakes for like 90 days, 120 days, give it 3, 4, 5 months, man, just patience, man. Especially if you've got any kind of money, if you got any kind of cash at all, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, even if it's on your credit cards and you've got like a credit line, things are going to be, don't spend it. Don't go buy ammo right now. Don't go buy guns right now. Don't go buy anything. Because in a couple of months, they're going to turn everything back on. They have to. Because if they don't, Carr and I had this conversation on Friday of like, I think, and I think Carr agrees with me, that they might have accidentally committed suicide. Like the neoliberal world order may have just completely, like just accidentally shot themselves in the face.
Yeah. No, I think they have.
And so I'm like, okay, I have no idea what's coming out of that, right? What replaces that? How they rebuild that? It's 150 years of political machinations that may have just collapsed on itself over an overreaction of a virus. Like, and so at some point in the next couple of weeks, somebody with some amount of recognition of what's going on is going to go, hey, we literally cannot afford to keep everything shut off anymore, because if we do, it's over. Mm-hmm. The whole neoliberal world order is over. I think it might already be done, but they just haven't realized it yet. But somebody's going to come to the realization of what they did and what happened, and they're going to go, hey, we got to turn this back on, and we got to turn it back on like yesterday, or like the American empire is gone and China might like legitimately starve 500 million people to death. And like, we have to turn this back on. It's coming.
Yeah.
And so when that happens, a lot of people are going to go, okay, big deep breath, we can make it, whatever. And things are going to go on sale, quote unquote, because people are going to go, hey, we're back to normal, but we've got backed up inventory. We haven't sold anything in 60 days, 90 days, whatever. We've got to get stuff out the door. We got to get revenue coming back in. We've got to make some sort of arrangement with our landlords about rent or our bank, about mortgages or whatever. We got to get some kind of cash coming in. And as soon as that happens, everything is going to go on sale. And then a year from now or 18 months from now, you're going to get another crash because the supply side stuff where it's like, hey, we haven't been able to get components from China. We had a, you know, 60-day delay or 90-day delay. We had enough inventory to get us through the year, but now we don't. We don't have components. We can't manufacture anything. You're going to get another wave of shutdowns and, you know, the foreclosures and evictions and all and the repossessions of cars. All that stuff's going to take a year to work its way through the system too.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I think we're seeing like this is the beginning of the first wave and it's going to crash midsummer or something like that. And then you're going to get a bounce, or it's going to look like a bounce because the economy is going to turn back on and come, quote, roaring back, unquote. But it's a false roar because there's underlying systemic issues.
Yeah.
That
it's a lot like, it's like shocking someone's heart back to life, you know, like it's a very violent situation and doesn't always work. You know, like you can give them the paddles and like their heart jerks and pumps, you know, through their circulatory system, but they might not be alive. You know, the economy might need more than that. It might need to die and be reborn because economies do not like sudden shocks at all. They like steady growth.
And it just got a massive shock.
Yes, massive, like unprecedented. Like
global scale, never seen before in human history.
Yeah, and I mean, there have been pandemics before, and there have been economic disruptions before. The economy has never been at this scale ever in the history of...
It's not just the scale. It's the interconnectedness. It's the global world order thing. It's the post-World Wars global world order where everybody and everything is interconnected.
Yeah.
Parts from cars that are built by a company that's headquartered in South Korea come from Mexico and Honduras and Guatemala and China and the Philippines and Vietnam and then are assembled in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Well, boy, that seems efficient and cheap on the surface until you realize that, like, hey, we haven't gotten a shipment in from China or Mexico in 9 months.
Right.
And now we have 80% of the components to build a car, but you can't build a car without 100% of the components.
Yep.
So, by the way, that car then just doesn't just not get built. Those components sit and rot. And so you don't just lose the value of the 80% of the 20% of components you're missing. You lose the value of the whole thing. It all goes. Plus the labor time of, hey, we built 80% of the car expecting the shipment to come in. It never came in. We spent all the labor and energy cost and the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, Ford, GM, Chrysler, the big legacy manufacturers, they're done.
Yeah.
They should have been done in 2008. They should have restructured, ditched the unions, complete. There's none of that this time. It's all gone. Like, they're fucked completely. Even Ford, who, like, didn't take the government money last time and got a bunch of goodwill for that, blah, blah, done. Finished. They won't be able to pay the legacy stuff. They won't be able to, like, there's no money to lend. Like, somebody on Twitter was like, oh, my God, $6 trillion. Like, our grandchildren are going to be paying this back. And I'm like, bitch, you don't understand.
We haven't even started.
Nobody's paying that back.
Yeah.
That's fake. That's not real.
This is all clown world. Like, none of this counts.
This is all clown world. None of this matters. None of this counts. Nobody's paying any of that back. Ever.
And here's something to add on to that. So what you're talking about the second wave in 12 to 18 months. Well, you're not wrong. Ford and GM, they're going down. Like, they're going to just get annihilated. Well, then imagine the supply crunch from having all of the major U.S. auto manufacturers, once their current crop, like once this 2019-2020 model year, once those are all off the lots and they start to depreciate and fall apart and people need to get a new vehicle, well, Ford and GM, they're gone. Like, the supply, yep. And again, that's part of that whole economies don't like sudden shocks thing. Like,
well, and I think, you know, long term, that's opportunity, right? Like, this is a reset. And I mentioned on Twitter today, like, hey, you know, we could have the great reset here. We could default.
Mm-hmm.
Say, hey, this is all funny money. We can't do this. Default, walk away. Don't pay anybody. Deal with the consequences right now. Rip the Band-Aid off and deal with it, right? Mm-hmm. But instead, they're not going to do that because they can't.
Yeah.
Right? The people in power do not, literally, do not have the ability to do that. They can't. They'll get murdered. Like, like, I'm not being figuratively. They will be torches and pitchforks, which are probably coming anyway, and they will be dragged into the streets and assassinated. Straight up. So, they can't. They have to play the funny money game. So I'm like, okay, so instead we're going to get Stockman's idea. We're going to get the great deformation, right? We're going backwards 50 years. But what that means is people like you and me that are in our 30s that are watching this and aren't in debt to our eyeballs and have already taken the pain and learned our lessons and blah, blah, whatever, there's going to be opportunities in 10 years when we're in our 40s to go, hey, there's this new idea, new car, new type of vehicle, not cars, right? Or like Tesla's going to take over because they're whatever, right? So there will be the market's the market, and the market will always exist because the market is just human action. Right. It's just two people trading. That's all it is. And then the scale of the market is just the number of people trading growing. And so at some point, demand will get high enough that somebody else will come along and build a new car. And hopefully, my hope is that this is big enough that it crushes the U.S. empire. That it destroys it. Because then the regulatory state goes and innovation can really flourish and we can see some really cool stuff. Like, between automation and computer tech, like the technology and the capital stock, that stuff's not going away. The human knowledge stuff, none of that's going away. And so if this is big enough to crush the empire and really, I mean, really crush the empire, the back end of this 10 to 15 years from now could be really, really awesome.
Yes, I am in firm agreement. That's actually like, and you know, this, I hate to sound callous, but it takes an event like this to crush the regulatory state. And that's the only way that we can come out of this and have a real economy again. Because imagine Ford, GM, Chrysler, it's all a thing of the past. Imagine trying to be an upstart auto manufacturer and having to go through all of the DOT shit at 2020 level, you know?
Oh, plus there's all that stuff, but there's also like, hey, the currency hasn't been backed by anything real for 100 years. So if you're starting now, you have to pay inflated prices to get in the game. If everything deflates, because that's what's coming, right? If everything deflates to a normalized level, all of a sudden the playing field levels out. So if you can get rid of the regulatory state, the bureaucratic nonsense of the American empire, and you can deflate the funny money and get back to some sort of solid footing for the monetary accounting system that you use in your economy, all of a sudden, like, the market can go just bananas. So I'm super bullish over the next 5 years. But I think, man, 10 to 15 years out, things could be real cool.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of potential. And I think it all hinges, because if we can destroy the regulatory state, or at least weaken it and incapacitate it enough to be meaningful for growth, then we have a good chance. What I'm worried about is that this wasn't the kill shot for that, and it's just going to double down, and like they're going to exert petty authority over the scraps of remaining industry and just continue to strangle it, even as we're already dying. So you get like a kind of a Soviet collapse situation where, you know, the bureaucracy was just strangling it and continued to strangle it, even as no one had the sense to just go, okay, we're only going to get through this if we just let it breathe.
See, I don't think that's going to happen, and here's why. When the Soviet collapse happened, yeah, you're right, but the bureaucratic state was so bad, mm-hmm. and they didn't just let it go, and then you got all the mob-style stuff in the 90s and all that. Mm-hmm. The difference being, they did not have the existing capital structures and market infrastructure that we have, mm-hmm. right? They had desecrated their existing capital stock and manufacturing base and whatever else. They had just been just raping the country for resources, basically, mm-hmm. for 90 years. And basically missed the Industrial Revolution, industrialized overnight, and then never, because they weren't under market conditions in any way, shape, or form, never innovated beyond 1950s level technology. Mm-hmm. And so when they collapsed, there was nothing except for the raw resources of the country to exploit, to bring the market back, right?
Yeah.
In the U.S., for all of its fascistic, you know, problems in the market and the bureaucratic regulatory state and everything else, there is an extremely high level of technical know-how and manufacturing expertise and manufacturing capital stock and resources and demand and a culture of markets and not a culture of I mean, the Russians, the Soviets had a culture of deprivation. They had learned through generations of hardship how to basically just make do, mm-hmm. right? Americans aren't used to making do. And so when this thing falls apart, like people get mad, like the, I mean, to the point of calling the cops when McDonald's doesn't put the right sauce in their chicken nugget meal.
Yeah.
Right? Like Americans have no concept of hardship or making do. And so there's not a cultural perspective of ho-hum, let you just one foot in front of the other and continue, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, my hope is this thing falls apart and falls apart quick, like less than 2 years. The whole thing collapses. The government can't pay its bills, can't pay the interest on anything. They bring all the overseas adventurism, all that stuff comes back because they can't afford it. You know, $2 trillion a year, it's just wiped off the books immediately. Mm-hmm. All that labor coming home, all those, you know, working age men that are overseas for no reason, all the, you know, I mean, we have, what is it, 9 massive nuclear power plants floating around the ocean all over the world for no reason.
Yeah.
You know, the carrier groups put out a ridiculous amount of power. You can dock those in the 9 biggest port cities in the world and provide basically free power.
What is the capacity of one of those? I'm not even familiar.
If it's not running shipboard operations, I don't know for sure, but it's going to be a big number.
It is going to be a big number.
I mean, I know that they're in the multi-kilowatt range just to run shipboard operations. And so if you literally beach the things, right, or dock them deep enough in the water that they can maintain the cooling systems on the nuclear reactors, and then just run transmission lines off the carrier and treat it like it's a nuclear power plant, I bet one of those things powers Los Angeles. You know,
good so bit park of it, it anyway.
Park,
yeah.
Or a decent size of it. So park it in Long Beach. And then, oh, by the way, it's immune to earthquakes.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought
so
about
now
that.
What? Like, I'm just looking at it going, hey, the capital stock of America, like, yeah, we've like completely debased the currency. It's all completely clown show, blah, 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 whatever. But in a lot of ways, we've taken that clown show debt, investment, foreign investment, and all that stuff, and we've put it to productive use. Mm-hmm. Like, that's been the saving grace of America over the last 50 years, is we didn't just blow it all up. I mean, we've blown a lot of it up, killed a lot of brown people overseas for no reason.
Right.
But in the process, you know, we've advanced metallurgy and we've advanced medical technology and we've advanced power generation and we've advanced all these other things. And the capital stock for all of the empire's bad toys, right? All the capital equipment is there. All the manufacturing capacity can be turned around to make other things immediately. That's kind of my point. It's like, man, if this whole thing crashes quick, you know, 2 years, 5 years, and it really just wipes the board clean, America comes out the other end looking pretty solid. Like, China's in trouble, right? They got over 1 billion people. They're more than half men. They've got a disproportionate population over 50. They've got a wildly disproportionate number of men over 50 who are single and haven't had any kids. Like, they've got a population decline coming that's going to just decimate their economy.
Right.
And when that happens, they're going to have a bunch of people starve to death. Like, the cities are overcrowded. They don't make enough food. Like, China's in trouble.
Yeah.
And there might be a couple of, like, major urban U.S. centers that are in trouble. New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. You know, a couple of places where it's like, man, people kind of aren't really meant to live here, especially in this density. And mm-hmm. we can't provide enough food or whatever. But the rest of the U.S. is going to be fine on a subsistence level. You know, the U.S. makes way more, we export way more food than we eat for all of our gluttony. And so, you know, we're not going to see mass starvation. You're not going to see, you know, massive breakdowns of societal norms. What you're going to see is a lot of, like, return to multi-generational housing and growing your own food and the victory garden concept. And a lot of that stuff is going to come back in vogue just because there's no money. Yeah. And so you're going to have to do some of that stuff to get by. But everybody's going to get by. And so you're going to have, you know, the industrial base and the work capacity and the human cap, all that stuff's going to be intact. And so as soon as you can reset the value of whatever currency you end up using after this, and it might be multi-currencies, right? It might be some crypto and some hard money and some new, you know, paper notes for small transactions. It might be a mix of things for a while. But as soon as you can get to, hey, the dollar doesn't exist anymore, or the U.S. empire doesn't exist anymore, and the Fed doesn't exist, as soon as you can get to that point and you can reset, like, it doesn't take very long from that reset to be back up and running bigger and better than before.
Yeah. I actually, I think that you're definitely onto something there. I have a couple of things to expound on. One of the big things, that I think is noteworthy is, as you said, the domestic capital and manufacturing base for the military is one of the most onshored things that we have, because it was onshored for national security purposes.
Correct.
So you can, you know, because of stuff like that and the Berry Amendment, you know, you have this big MIC military industrial complex that's already here. So the first companies that can realize that the jig is up and that the torches and pitchforks are coming and front run that and beat their swords into plowshares, they're going to be in really good position to help recover the domestic economy. And I think that you'll also see that, like, with the larger corporations, the ones that, you know, see which way the wind's coming and, like, try to take less of the focus away from federal regulation, like, maybe just doing the right thing in spite of what the feds are saying, and then kind of trying to draw the power balance away. And the third thing that I was thinking is that smaller companies that have, like, a higher knowledge base and, you know, good, motivated employees, they're going to be more apt to pivot to where the market needs to be supplied, like, domestically. You know, like, just a casual example would be, like, people doing a 3D printing farm to make replacement parts for aging vehicles, domestic appliances, you know, whatever. Like, some sort of stopgap in order to keep the things running while everything else resets. Which I think, you know, that sort of thing, that was going to be happening eventually anyway. So it's just now we're working without a net. Like, things are going live and we didn't expect it. So the people that are well positioned are going to be able to come out of this better, even in like the corporate and the manufacturing sense, you know, as far as being able to deliver the goods that the people actually need.
Yeah, I think that's 100% correct. And I think, you know, if you have been maintaining your company, if you're like a mid-size Midwestern manufacturer, right, and you make components for Ford or Chrysler or GM or whatever, mm-hmm. and you've managed to maintain your debt at appropriate levels and run your company pretty lean, right, and you've taken advantage of some of the automation tech, you've invested, like, you rode the 2008 collapse through, took advantage of kind of the no interest loans for that industry, updated all your equipment and machinery and manufacturing, cleaned out your employee base and your you know, human capital, and kind of cleaned all that up and got lean and efficient and heavily automated. Mm-hmm. You're in a position when this all falls apart to be like the next car manufacturer, right? You're already mm-hmm. set up to manufacture components. Now all you have to do is manufacture the rest of them. The other thing is, like, and there's going to be a big push towards not just like globalization, decentralization, but like decentralization as in, hey, we can get these parts from 35 different people or 45 different people. And we want to get parts from a bunch of different places instead of one centralized place that's overseas. So that if there's a pandemic in Vietnam, the Chinese manufacturer is not affected. Or if there's a pandemic globally, we've got somebody here in the U.S. that can make something to keep us alive, right? And so right. I think one of the things you're probably going to see is a massive return to onshoring some level of manufacturing, especially with automation. So if you're in a technical field or you're capable of learning technical stuff and how to run automated machines and all that stuff, like, you may come out looking pretty sweet on the end of this of like, hey, I've got a really awesome job in a factory working, not doing the like heavy manufacturing labor, but maintaining the machines and programming and that kind of stuff. Right. A lot of that stuff is coming. A lot of that stuff was coming anyway, right? The yeah. automation wave has been coming for a long time. It's starting to pick up. A lot of this, I think, I really do. I know there's a lot of doom and gloom coming of like, hey, like the next 5 to 10 years could be really ugly.
Yeah.
But on the back end of this, as it all kind of works its way through, as long as we don't end up with like full-blown international fascist dictatorial governments, right, the world over out of this thing, as long as the whole thing collapses and resets, I think we're going to be pretty awesome on the back end of it. And I think the chances of full-blown dictatorial, you know, international fascism is slimmer than a lot of people want to think, because it's fun to, you know, war game the boogeyman.
Yeah.
But that takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of manpower and, like, the ability to really crack down like that.
That's something that a lot of people, like, they're kind of forgetting what we've been talking about for a long time, which is, for instance, the United States as an entity does not have the force to project to do that sort of fascistic like lockdown. Like, right now, the lockdown that we're experiencing is kind of
totally
just
voluntary.
Totally voluntary. Like, they don't yep. have the enforcement capability
nope.
to actually follow through with it. So you can't assume that they're going to just, like, there's not enough tanks in the streets. There's not enough tankers to put in the tanks.
Oh, like, it gets as soon as you start doing that math, and you, I mean, if you talk to the guy, the biting the bullet guys, like, Typo used to be an intel enlisted guy for a tank battalion, mm-hmm. and so he's got all the math on like what it takes to run a tank battalion.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the supply chain that you need to maintain one M1 Abrams mm-hmm. is insane.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Like,
and they've only made 10,000 of those things, and more than half of them are overseas. So you got to get them back anyway.
Yeah.
They're in Europe and they're staged in Africa and the Middle East for like ground wars with other people because they take forever because you can't put them on planes except for C5s. You can get one on a C5, but the fuel cost of getting it back on a plane is amazing. So they ship them. They ship them. And when they've done that, what they do is they've pre-staged them all over the world. Mm-hmm. So there's like less than 3,000 M1 Abrams stateside.
Yeah. They just don't have enough.
Nope.
And there's not enough boots. There's not enough boots to put on the ground. Like this
even
whole thing.
If you assume 100% retention, meaning everybody that's on active duty now doesn't go AWOL when you try to do the lockdown, there's not, you do the math and you just go, yeah, good luck.
Yeah.
Like you might get the major cities, a couple, you know, you might get 10 or 15 of the major cities, but you're not getting the countryside.
Right.
You're not getting Appalachia and you're not getting the Rockies. Like, just not going to happen.
Yeah. That goes back to just, like, it's difficult to control the landmass that is America. Like, whether it be a foreign invader or domestic control, like, you can't. It's a paper tiger when it comes down to it. You know, it's just there to keep people in line with the threat. The actual.
Yeah, there's a scene that I posted in response to somebody the other day. That's just a scene out of the movie A Bug's Life. And have you seen that movie? Like,
yeah, what
20 years the grasshoppers. Yeah. So the grasshoppers are in their like little cantina. They've just raided the ants. They've got this food and they're talking about like, why are we going to go back and get more food from them? We got enough, blah, blah. And Hopper, the like main bad guy grasshopper, has this whole speech about, you know, they've got this like seed jar and there's these three grasshoppers that are like ringleading, like, hey, let's not go back. So Hopper takes one of the seeds and throws it on him. He's like, hey, did that hurt? And he goes, no. He throws another one at him. Did that hurt? No. And then he pulls the stopper out of the bottle and crushes them.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, those ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, our way of life is over.
Yep.
And it's
that's
like,
actually, I thought about that scene when we started to get the rumors of the default on the rents, like the rent strike, because
you can't evict them all.
You cannot evict them all. Like, and that I think in the short term is probably the biggest wild card, because the way I war gamed it, and I theorized it, that you can go back and look, it was in February, but I theorized it, that they can't, it's kind of like you were saying, the powers that be, they can't not play the funny money game. So they have to respond.
It's the only
to the rent
they
strike. Yeah. So they can't not respond to a rent strike, because then no one will pay rent ever again. So, but that's the biggest wild card, because that involves a conflict. Like, you can't really war game that. Because there's too many variables.
The fun part is, hey, let's have a rent strike. Okay. So we had a rent strike in April. So the courts are shut down.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
All evictions, all foreclosures, everything is delayed.
Yep.
So even in Texas, where you're 6 to 8 weeks out from a court date and you go to court, and if they didn't pay rent, it's mandatory grounds for eviction. And they'll have the eviction notice on Monday, and the sheriff is there pulling you out of the apartment the next Monday if you haven't already gotten out. Even in Texas, if they turn everything back on and let the courts open May 1st, it's going to take a year to process all those evictions.
Right.
By that time, all of those people will have walked away.
Mm-hmm.
Rents will have come down or readjusted. Housing prices will have collapsed. You're not going to want to lose the renters if they're paying rent again. So they didn't pay you for 6 months, and now they're like, hey, here's a new offer, $500 a month.
Right.
I was paying $1,000, but now I'm paying $5.
Yep.
You're going to take it because it's the only revenue you've got.
Yeah. You have no leverage at that point.
None,
like
zero.
Your leverage is the continuity of enforcement, and continuity of enforcement has been completely blown up. So now the tenant, as the incumbent person in the domicile, they have all of the leverage, like, because are you going to do? You can't just go in and like drag them out.
If they decide to dig, if they decide to dig in like ticks, you are in deep shit.
Yep.
They can do so much more damage to your property than it's worth.
Right.
That you're better off letting them live there for free in a lot of cases until they're ready to move on.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's people are, I think there's enough people that realize that, that it's going to be kind of inevitable. It won't be like 100% participation.
We got an email from our apartment complex. We live in a complex that's managed by a massive, like, national chain that owns apartment complexes all over the U.S. Mm-hmm. And they were like, hey, come talk to us about setting up payment plans. Like, they're already ahead of, like, they're not even letting the idea of rent strike get started in any of their properties. They're like, hey, come talk to us about what your situation is. We'll figure something out. We'll work out payment plans. We'll defer until next month, blah, blah, whatever. Like, they already know, right?
Yeah.
They already know that they are in for a like, man, and I live in, you know, I live in Austin. It's Commieville. Like, if anybody puts together a little bit of organization for, like, hey, rent strike against management company XYZ, like, oh boy.
Yeah. That, I think that the larger commie enclaves, like Austin, San Francisco, Seattle, those are probably going to be the biggest ones at first. And then I think that it may have the potential to spread out to some of the smaller major cities from there, where you might see like neighborhoods or, you know, just individual rental units, you know, like one building with 32 tenants or however many.
I saw that you posted that comment from next door, like the one guy owns 32 units in the building.
Yeah.
That's not the one that's crazy to me. The one that's crazy to me is the guy that owns like 15 rental houses.
Uh-huh.
And like, if his 15 tenants get together and they don't pay on the individual houses, forget the apartment complex. Like, the apartment complex, it's a business. It's in a business's name. You declare Chapter 11, restructure, you're fine, right? You can weather that storm. It sucks, but you can do it. Mm-hmm. If you've bought 15 houses over time in your own name, and three of those foreclose on you, and then the other three, you can't pay, like, that snowball of, like, man, houses are about to get real cheap.
Oh, insanely cheap, because at that point, they are liabilities. So it's like the cars, they're not assets.
They always have been. That's the thing nobody understands, is everybody's been lied to, like, hey, a house is your biggest asset. And the answer is, not if you have debt on it, it isn't.
Right.
And not if you don't actually live in it, it isn't. Even if it's an income generating asset on your balance statement.
Yeah.
The second that revenue dries up, it is a massive liability.
Yeah.
And if you're leveraged on that, forget it. And I know, because I've been there.
What I foresee is you're going to, like, take the landlord with 15 houses. Like you said, they're all in his name. He's going to default on them. So what I think is most likely to happen is, I think there's going to be a lot of instances where the bank goes to the current tenant and says, look, we'll sell you this house that you're living in. Just pay us like $300.
How? How do you go to the tenant that's living there for free?
Oh, no,
can't pull out of there.
This is on like a 1 to 2 year timeline.
Oh, no. No. This is a 5 to 10 year timeline.
You think it'll be that long?
This is the industry I have spent the last decade working in.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This is.
See, I'm looking at it from the outside. I don't have any hands-on experience.
No. I used to have rental properties. I fix people's rental properties for a living. I've got lots of friends that are investors. I know what happened in 2008. Like, in Florida, they just finished, like, a year ago, getting the last couple of people out of houses that, like, foreclosed on in 2008.
Oh, God. Yeah, see, if it's a 5 to 10 year thing, then my idea breaks down, because there's no... I mean, you can't do it at that
They're point. Not like, paying, and it's not just... They're not paying because they don't want to pay.
Right.
They're not paying because they can't pay.
Yeah.
So they didn't pay the landlord, so now the bank's going to foreclose on the landlord, right? Mm-hmm. So the bank now owns the property, and they go to the existing tenants and go, hey, you weren't paying the landlord, so we'll offer you a better deal. And they go, we weren't paying the landlord because we couldn't afford to pay the landlord. Now what?
Right.
Okay, we're gonna evict you. Good. fucking luck for the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, hey, we evicted you, and now the house is just going to sit empty, and now we have to pay for security and maintenance, and like, no, it's about to get real ugly.
That's true, and that's even assuming easy continuity, because yep. I'm guessing foreclosures take a while. And again, looking at it from the outside, I wasn't familiar with real estate at all, but from my understanding, like the mortgage-backed securities debacle, part of it was nobody knew who owned what. So sorting through all of the convoluted chains, like if company X bought the mortgage from company Y, tracing that back, that's just an additional layer of...
Yeah, and by the way, that's a really successful way to fight your foreclosure, because of federal law, they have to provide original documentation. They generally don't keep that original documentation for more than 2 years. And if it's sold if the mortgage is sold 3 or 4 times, they don't have any of the original documentation.
Oh man.
So you can literally fight them and get the house for free because they can't prove you owe them money.
And again, it's one of those because things.
The deed says you owed Bank ABC. Well, Bank ABC went out of business 5 years ago. Bank XYZ now owns the mortgage, but they can't prove the whole chain of ownership. And as soon as they can't prove the whole chain of ownership, the ownership defaults to the person on the deed who bought. So there's the mortgagee and the mortgager. And so the person that's left on the deed that's left standing, they get the house.
Wow.
It's going to be bad, dude.
That's another one of those things where it's just completely dependent on continuity. So... Yep. Like, people pay their mortgage because that's what you do. And now, well, I can't afford to pay it. Now what? You know?
Oh, and I don't have anywhere else to go because my parents are out of their house and I've got three kids or whatever. And I can't go anywhere else. Mm-hmm. My credit's screwed. I don't have a job. I don't have a deposit. I can't qualify for anything. I'm not going anywhere. You're going to have to pull me out of this thing like a tick that's dug all the way in.
Yep.
Anyway, this has been fun. On a positive note, I think 10 years from now, everybody's going to be really good. The next 5 to 10 years is going to be, could be really ugly. But I got to go have dinner with the family and all that. Anna, that's, I think we lost you at some point. Are you still around?
No, I'm still here. I'm just quietly agreeing with you.
All right. Well, G-Man, I think we should check back in. I told Carl the same thing, like in a month, and go,
Hey,
all those things that we said. Yeah. Those things are coming true. So, or not. Maybe things will, you know, maybe they'll be able to kick the can down the road another year.
Who knows? I'm perfectly willing to be wrong. I'll admit it as soon as anyone else.
Yeah, same. I just don't think I am.
I don't either.